Welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. Now, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I'd like to introduce you to Sophia Sharina, who is doing a PhD in English Literature and Creative Writing under the supervision of Dr. Glenn Wilmot. Welcome to Grad Chat, Sophia.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I'm really excited to dive into your research today. But before we get into your topic, could you tell us a little bit about kind of your academic journey so far and what attracted you to Queen's in the first place for your research?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so I'm originally from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, and I did an undergraduate there, a Bachelor of Arts Honors in English Literature, and I finished in 2020, so there was some world stuff happening at the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I had already applied to a master's here at Queen's, so I moved here in 2020 to do a master's, a one-year course-based master's, and I really loved the program here and my supervisor, so I decided to stay. And so now I'm in my fifth year of my PhD, so hoping to finish soon, knock on wood. And yeah, so that's been my experience so far. I entered university not knowing what I was going to major in. I was an undeclared arts major for 3 years before I decided on English. I took a breadth of courses, and I really loved everything I took. My parents, thankfully, are really supportive, and so they both have degrees in fields that they no longer work in. Mm. So they were really supportive in me kind of taking a lot of different kinds of courses and seeing what I enjoyed and what I was good at, and knowing that no matter what sort of courses you're taking, you're building a basin of knowledge that you can draw upon no matter where you end up. Mm-hmm. So having that support was obviously huge, and also, you know, fantastic mentors in my undergrad that encouraged me and said, you should try grad school. We think you'd enjoy it. You'd be good at it. You know, there's a lot of fun there too. Mm-hmm. And so obviously thankful for the opportunity. And yeah, I've really enjoyed my time doing graduate school.
That's great, because it is, grad school can be a big commitment, but I think it's if you come in with like a very open attitude, it can be a lot of fun because you get so much flexibility to explore a topic that you might not get the chance to do otherwise.
Yeah.
To dedicate full-time study to something mm-hmm. like this. So I mean, I'm biased as well, but I agree. I'm glad that you're here with us and that we get to talk about your research project today. So your topic is titled Imagining New Divinities in 20th Century Speculative Fiction. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that means as your research unfolds?
Sure. So studying speculative fiction is kind of an umbrella term that normally encompasses fantasy and science fiction and other sort of speculation, right? Mm-hmm. So an author asking a question saying, what if this was the world? And their stories are thought experiments in considering what those possible worlds could look like. So my work is on the intersections of speculative fiction, literary study, and religion. Mm-hmm. And so the books that I study are often taking place in a speculative world, a fantasy mm-hmm. world, a science fiction world. And my interest is in the author's creation as a part of that world building of a sort of divine element or spiritual mm-hmm. element, and looking at their creation of religion, what I call story religion, in that world, and how that story religion is different from religion that exists in our world that mm-hmm. we call the primary world. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times I study through the lens of modernity, which means it's a umbrella term in another way of a series of aesthetic motifs that appear in literature from around 1880 to 1945. Okay, so it's that period that encompasses the First and Second World Wars, where there was a lot of change in the way that authors were writing. Mm-hmm. So the Victorian period, which is the kind of era before that, was focused a lot of the time on realism. And so modernism, the kind of period after that, there was a lot of exploration mm-hmm. and experimentation. So to pull all those pieces together, it's looking at the ways that authors of speculative fiction, and I look at the 20th century when those books were published, were using the sort of experimentation of modernity as a way to make sense of the trauma of that period that encompassed so much change in the sense of, you know, global war, increasing awareness of ecological change, and massive upheavals of social structures, including women's liberation and other civil rights movements. So all of those changes, I think, were creating such change in the world. So my work looks at how speculative fiction authors are making sense of all of that change through this other avenue of a world that is not our own, but like our own, to sort of explore really big questions, perhaps without the baggage of, you know, the primary world and reality kind of tied to it.
No, that makes a lot of sense because it's, the period that you mentioned, the late 19th century and early 20th century, is massive, massive changes experienced around the world, too. It's a global period of change. So within these texts that you're looking at, can you tell us a little bit about what the texts are that you are primarily working with to explore these ideas of story, religion, and world building?
Yeah. So I work with some pretty big texts and really popular ones, because the idea is not only how authors were dealing with these topics in their stories, but also how readers were able to also think through those really big questions in their reading of these texts. So I read The Lord of the Rings, which is, I mean, an honor and a privilege, something that I feel crazy saying of, it's my job to read Lord of the Rings. And I also study Dune, so Frank Herbert's Dune series. And I also study two feminist speculative fiction texts, Charlotte Perkins Gilman's Herland, and a text by Joanna Russ called The Female Man. They're lesser known, but one is from the early 1900s and one is from 1970. So they kind of cover a really broad period of time and have two really different approaches to feminist speculative fiction and have two really different story religions within them. The best way that I can normally explain story religion is with the example of Game of Thrones.
Okay.
Because people are familiar with it. They've seen the show. Mm-hmm. They've maybe read the books. So in that world, George R.R. Martin has created pretty specific religions that are institutions. There's the seven, where there's the seven deities. It's a hierarchical, organized religion. There are, you know, levels of power and the people who are presiding over that. And it has been deeply imbued into society, into certain societies, and they reflect that society, and that society operates in accordance to, or sometimes in opposition to, the rules of that institution. There's also, in that same world, the old gods, which the Starks are associated with. Then there's the Lord of the Light. There's other groups that have different deities. So the way that that world is built, we can see how different groups of people are following these different institutions and how that is reflected in the way that their society works, the way that they see the world, how they move throughout the world, and also for us stepping outside of it, are able to project onto it our knowledge of the way that institutionalized, hierarchical, organized religion operates in our world and can kind of see it from a different point of view. So that is the best way to examine story religion. And so in Dune, there's the examples of the Bene Gesserit, the Fremen. There's a text, a sacred text called the Orange Catholic Bible, which is insane, but really interesting. So there's all these different groups, and we can examine the people within those groups and see what the author is trying to tell us about religion in a lot of ways. Whereas in the last example of The Lord of the Rings, it is not a specific organized religion. There is no mention of sacred text, ritual, dogma, but there is this imbued spirituality, especially from Tolkien's The Silmarillion, which is kind of the world creation story of that world. But he's taken a very different approach than, let's say, Frank Herbert, where it's all subtle and deeply imbued into the story, which means that it's more open to interpretation. And there is, in scholarship, a lot of people who talk about, you know, exploring religion for the first time through reading The Lord of the Rings, even if they don't have a background or, you know, weren't raised in religion, but they sense something in it that they felt drawn to or some sort of connection to divinity. So that's really at the root of what I'm interested in, is how through these story worlds we are glimpsing from different angles this kind of fractured prism of divinity and how it operates and how we experience it and how we can glimpse a sort of proximity to it, sometimes through reading a world that is not like our own.
No, it makes a lot of sense that it sounds like it gives us the distance to question things in our own world, but that we wouldn't be able to see otherwise. They've been made invisible in our day-to-day lives and institutions, but when we read these speculative fiction stories, we're able to then, you know, ask questions of a world that an author has created that, you know, maybe we can't ask of our own without reading it through with the author first, and then able to reflect those questions back onto our lived experience.
Yeah, and there's an openness, I think, mm-hmm. when we open a world that allows you to kind of leave reality behind in a way and open yourself to something new. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think they are so popular, right? So studying these texts, they are some of the most, we call it canonical in literary mm-hmm. study. They are well established, considered to be, you know, most foundational to their genres of fantasy and science fiction. Mm-hmm. So studying those, they're rich texts. There's mm-hmm. a lot there for me mm-hmm. to look into.
So that's how you're approaching story religion. And how are you approaching an analysis of world building in your works as well? And a follow-up question I would have is, what does world building give you in terms of analysis in comparison to story religion, which you've just explained very nicely for us? So.
Yeah, so story religion is obviously a component of world building. World building is this, I've said umbrella term three times now, but it is, there's kind of these large areas that I'm examining and then kind of diving deeper and mm-hmm. deeper into. But world building is the process of an author or creator of any kind, I just happen to deal with literature, mm-hmm. of creating a world that is deeply considered in lots of ways. It's not just, okay, this is a story that I'm making up and there are people in it and this is about them and everything is different from our world. Mm. It's about the more nuanced connections in which an author or a creator can say, this world has different social structures than ours, or it has different climate than ours, or it has a different history than ours. That's things like alternative history, speculative fiction, like The Man in High Tower is a good example of this. So it's speculation, obviously, but once you kind of follow that line of inquiry, then you develop a world. I taught a course on world building, and the thing that I told my students was, a speculative fiction author is kind of like an annoying toddler who's just asking, but why? But why? But what about this? Or, well, why is it this way? And a speculative fiction author, a lot of the time, has this big question of, you know, in the instance of Dune, what if there was a planet that had a really rare resource and it was entirely one biosphere? So the entire planet was desert. What happens? Okay, well, there's not a lot of water. That becomes a sacred resource. Then the Fremen, as a group of people, have developed a religion around the sacredness of water. So that is how, like, you know, the several steps that you kind of take from the first big question down through, okay, how does this reflect in their society? So then you go deeper. How does the sacredness of water appear in the society of these people? Well, they wear jewelry that have water counters on them. And giving someone a water counter is normally a gesture of a relationship or a gesture of looking to have a relationship with them. But also it appears in their other rites. So funeral rites become about the water. There is a scene in the text and in the movies, if you're familiar, where when a Fremen dies, there is kind of sacred words said over them, and it is said that their water is returned to the group. So their soul is their own, but their water belongs to the collective. So this is, you know, the way that a speculative fiction author will kind of take steps down in their building of a world. And when worlds are successful, it's because they have connected each of these things to each other in ways that make sense. Nothing feels random. Everything you can kind of tie back to, oh, no, this makes sense given the way that this society operates. And that's when we praise world building, is when everything feels like it's cohesive and harmonizing together. And there's a reason for everything. I think the world building that we critique will often feel disconnected and disjointed, and like there's plot holes and things that don't make sense. So that's a kind of roundabout way of discussing how world building can relate to story religion. And the care that authors take in their world building is where, as a literary scholar, you can come in and examine those choices and see how they improve our experience of reading or just make that experience more immersive.
No, and it sounds incredibly challenging, too, to do this well, which is, I mean, why you're working with such canonical texts because I think they resonate with people, right? Because like you've described, there's consistency throughout. It makes sense. The cultures of these worlds make sense. Even I'm less familiar with Dune, but of course, like the languages in the Lord of the Rings, like there's so much depth within these stories that sometimes feel almost peripheral to like the narrative or the plot per se, but they're all there. And if you try to uncover any, you know, if you have a question about something and you look closer to the text, the author has already thought about it and you can find your answer.
I mean, the best part about that in terms of the Lord of the Rings is that Tolkien started with language. He never intended to write a story about hobbits. He was a linguist and he was trying to make sense of something that he read in a poem when he was a student at Oxford. He read an Anglo-Saxon poem by someone who they call Cynewulf. It was called a Christ poem, so a Christ poem. And it literally said, "Hail Arendelle, brought unto man above this middle earth," or something like this. And he became fixated on this figure. And all of everything that we now know was the Lord of the Rings, the sprawling series, the histories of Middle Earth that have continued to be written, the books, all of this, it comes from him finding this word, Arendelle. And instead of approaching it like, and I don't mean this to say he isn't a creative writer, but instead of approaching it like a creative writer of, this sounds like an interesting character, I'd like to write a story about it. He said, who was this person? And he began to invent a language and would treat his language creation like archaeology. He would, if he found errors in the language, instead of thinking, oh, I need to fix that, he would say, well, why would that happen? And that's how he would develop the history of language. Say, he had created a series of words and he had two different groups of people who were speaking this language. Instead of saying, oh, they say something differently from each other, he would say, no, there's a story in the past where these two groups have met and that's why this word is shared between them, or something like this. So Tolkien beginning in language is kind of the perfect example of world building, in the sense that he knew that languages need speakers to develop. And so he created speakers to develop his language. Yeah.
No, it's very interesting the lengths to which different authors go to create worlds. And I mean, with Tolkien, it's decades, it's a lifetime of work, right? So it's very interesting to see how you're able to explore this against other texts and what other authors have done to learn from all of this analysis. And you mentioned that you have recently taught courses in the Department of English and Creative Writing. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that course was and what it was like?
Yeah, so I just the one class so far, knock on wood, I'd love to do it again. The course was under the course code Literature and the Fantastic, but as a teaching fellow, I had the incredible opportunity to develop my own syllabus and my own class. So I created a class that was world building and popular genre fiction.
Very
and
cool.
It was the best. My students were incredible. I had 90 students.
Wow.
We had, you know, split the semester in half. So we did half on science fiction, half on fantasy. And we got to talk about the ways that world building appeared in these texts and what those authors are trying to tell us about our world through the choices that they've made in those stories. So we read some canonical texts like Ursula K. Le Guin's Wizard of Earthsea, but we also read newer texts like Becky Chambers's Monk and Robot, which is this solar punk ecotopia story. I loved it. Some of my students didn't love it, but that's okay. I would encourage them to disagree with me, of course. But it was so fun to get to, you know, read some texts for the first time with them or to watch them read things that I was more familiar with. And I was so impressed with the quality of work that came out of that. I gave an assignment that I gave them total freedom in, where I said, choose any story world that you want. I'm not going to grade your grammar or your writing. I'm not going to grade anything other than your ideas. Just tell me about a story world that you love and how it works. What is one element of that story world, that world building, that you think makes it effective? I got the most diverse answers I never expected, but some of them were so well done. I got one about Monster High,
Okay, yeah.
And the student day, like, included images so I could really see the whole thing. It was incredible. I got some about video games that I've never played but I've heard about anime, movies. There was one that was about, and this is so funny, it was one of the first ones I got, and I was blown away by it. It was on Idiocracy, which is this not super well-known movie from the 2000s, but it's speculative fiction in the way that it kind of has to do with time and a sort of dystopia future. And the student did a great job breaking it down. I was expecting to get, you know, a bunch on, you know, canonical science fiction and fantasy stories, but they really took what I gave them and ran with it, and it was so fun to see the way that they were able to make connections from the thing that they really cared about, knew a lot about, to the content from the course. So that was probably, like, the best part of the class for me, but I also just loved being in a room of people who were also nerdy about this kind of same thing and would love to talk about their experience reading the texts and thinking about them, or coming back to some things that they maybe read as children. We read The Wizard of Oz, which is really fun, and seeing it in a new light after, you know, talking a lot about theory of world building.
Well, that sounds great to see your students taking the critical thinking and analytical skills that you developed with them over the term and then applying it to, you know, things that they've already loved, or maybe engaged with something new, to whether, like, whatever the medium may be, but to see them, you know, to then enact it on their own. I feel like that's quite rewarding as an instructor, right? To be like, oh my gosh, they got it. Because you never quite know when you're teaching. Like, you're checking in with people and your students, and you're hoping that they're understanding the lessons. But it's great to hear that that assignment went so well, because I think that demonstrates that, yes, they understood, and yes, they were excited to apply it. So hopefully they'll keep those lessons in their mind moving forward when they, you know, encounter other worlds in whatever medium that story may appear in.
And that is not to say I didn't also teach them writing.
Of course. no question there.
I gave them one assignment that I said, writing doesn't matter. Everything else, we talked a lot about writing. It was still an English literature course. I taught a lot of writing skills, essay writing, all of this. Mm-hmm. But it was something different I could do that I thought was, you know, from a pedagogy point of view, perhaps removing the pressure that, you know, as we design courses now, we're constantly aware of AI. Mm-hmm. And English literature is obviously really dealing with that in its own way. And so I called these reflection assignments deconstructing worlds. Mm. And so that assignment was me kind of telling students, if you ever feel pressure to use some sort of writing, to cheat using AI or some other writing aid, This is a way for you to not have to worry about that. Mm-hmm. Set any concerns like that aside. I'm not looking at your grammar or your sentence structure. It can be jot notes. I don't care. I just want your ideas. Mm-hmm. And trying to validate their work on that and saying, your ideas are really good. Mm-hmm. Getting to really be a cheerleader in that sense. My hope was that they could take that confidence into the assignments where I was looking at their writing after we had, you know, been learning about writing for a whole semester. Mm-hmm. And I did see great examples of students who were maybe not the most confident writers, but able to, you know, feel buoyed a little bit by that practice and the feedback that I was able to give them into the end of the term, their final exam and their final paper.
No, that's great. It sounds like you've designed a well-scaffolded course, right, that helps students build their skills, build their confidence, and kind of do like a graduated build towards that, the big writing projects, which may be intimidating at first, but once students know that, A, their ideas are good and they have good ideas that are applicable. And then two, once they've had the chance to practice those writing skills and other assignments, they can then apply both the confidence and validation of the ideas plus the writing skills that you've developed with them to those big final projects, which hopefully they can take forward in their futures.
I hope so, yeah.
Yeah, no, that sounds very exciting. So it was, how did you find this relating to your research? Because you're teaching world building, which it's a large part of your research, but of course you're not looking at some of the big texts that you're looking at, because that would be hard to teach in a within the confines of a semester, to say, please go read Dune in a week or 2 weeks. I don't think a lot of students would be very happy with that. So how does this course relate to your research so far?
I have heard of courses where they do that, but it's been summer courses.
Okay.
At the U of S, there was this one science fiction course that they would do over a summer. It was an accelerated 6-week course, and they were reading Dune in a week, Lord of the Rings in a week, and it sounded insane, but very fun if you were able to just do that for 6 weeks. I mean, what a dream. But learning about world building, I think it's everything that the dissertation is doing. But it was also a moment for me to really dig into theory for the first time in a while and to get back to basics in a lot of ways. So that now when I return to the dissertation, I'm looking at things in a slightly different way and able to maybe piece apart the techniques that these authors are using based on the language that I kind of learned with my students as I taught that course. There's a bit of a risk in designing a course where you think, I'm not really an expert on some parts of this yet, but teaching the class, knowing you have to lecture twice a week, it's you learn a lot and you have a good reason to. You want to be confident in the front of the room. But I also try to really be open with students when I made mistakes and when I got something wrong. Or, you know, there was times that I was explaining theory and realized, I think I'm actually lying to you. Give me a minute. Go back to the text, read it over, say, okay, let's try this again. And, you know, I think you could be embarrassed when that happens, but I felt like it was good pedagogy in a sense to say, I am willing to fail here in front of you, and I'm not going to be embarrassed about that because it happens when you are learning. And I wanted to provide them that experience of knowing you can not understand things or you can get it wrong. And in this community of learners, we're going to support each other. We are going to accept that that happens, and we're going to work together to figure out what we need to figure out. So in a lot of ways, teaching the class, I learned a lot about world building, and that will help me in the dissertation. But I think I also learned a lot about just teaching and pedagogy, and that was something I was so excited about. It's what initially drew me to Queen's was the fact that in our department, you are guaranteed marking TA-ships for 2 years, tutorial leading TA-ships for at least 1 year, and a teaching fellowship. And other institutions you go to don't have that. And I think that might be changing in the future, which is really sad, I think. So I feel very lucky that I had the opportunity to design a course that was my dream course. And I got to teach it with a fantastic group of students, and I learned so much from them. So, of course, it relates to the dissertation, but I think also just as I am still myself a student, I learned a lot about teaching and about pedagogy and designing courses and dealing with students and working with TAs and designing assignments, and got to kind of live the dream for a semester, which was so fun. Yeah, it was so fun. And it was in some ways a step aside from the dissertation, but that was, you know, it means that I'm coming back to the dissertation clear-headed and ready to kind of step into it and look at it in a new way.
Yes, come back with some fresh ideas. And even though it may not look like complete forward progress on the dissertation, I think all the thinking and the learning that you've done from your teaching will just enrich your dissertation when you come back to it, right? And as the instructor, to also hear students' perspective, right? Because they bring such different ideas to a text that you've read. So it just helps refresh and you know, helps sharpen your points on how you think about a text. So I think it's great that you've had the chance to go in the classroom, and then you'll come back with fresh ideas and a little bit more time, or maybe a lot more time. Yes, writing a lecture is not for the faint of heart, and twice a week is a lot. So
it was fun. I loved it.
Well, thank you so much, Sophia, for coming on the show. It has been great chatting with you, and best of luck with the rest of your research as you kind of return back to dissertation mode.
Thank you so much. This was so much fun.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.